I'm a real deal. I'll shoot your liver out and hand it to you.
You gotta manscape your landscape.
Well, that was a perfect time to press start on the recording thing.
Wow.
We got that, Rob. How'd that feel?
Good.
I think
make those little boys glow.
I think Simon Cowell's going to be calling you up just to let you know how good of a singer you are.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are here for another week, and boy, is it a hectic week for me. This is like probably the craziest, busiest I've ever been in an entire week. And you're going to get to find out why a little bit later on in this podcast, which is going to be exciting. But for now, we're just going to leave that as a cliffhanger. Demetrius, how are you doing?
Fantastic. How about you?
I am living the dream. I am ready to have 2 weeks go by, so I am no longer busy. But until then, we are rocking on all cylinders. And
so where are you going in 2 weeks, Nate?
Well, I'll just have the women's VG9 done, and I'll have this exciting news that we're going to be talking about in about 15 minutes underway, so I don't have to worry about that. And yeah, it'll just be a nice little time to relax and kind of calm down and take a breath for a second. There's lots of things going on. All right, let's jump right in. Rob, you are going to go get the vaccine today, the first shot of the vaccine, so we got to get your pretty little bumpkin out there so you can get there on time.
Yes, I get my first injection today.
And how excited
and
are you?
I hope they put the chip in me.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
because I need to know where I am, and if I have a chip in me, I can maybe go on the internet and find me.
Yeah, worst case scenario is you could always call up the government.
If you fall off the edge of the flat earth, you know, we can reel you back. Yeah.
And of course, if you always call the government, and they can tell you where you're at because they got that tracking device in, you know.
Yeah, the tracking, and then there's the unique part of that chip that alerts you when you actually think about something and have an original idea. You get a little jolt, so you know you did that.
Well, what if the thoughts you start having aren't all yours? You know, you're starting to think things like, you know, gosh, I wonder what show I should watch tonight. What should I have for lunch? I wonder if I should, you know, go kill that Russian operative. Wait a second, that's not my thought. Where did that come from? You know, you start thinking about like, okay.
How many thoughts do we have that are original?
I don't know, but this is so far off the scale of what I thought this was going to turn into.
When you said you want to get things rolling.
Come on, let's do these shout-outs. Let's go, boys.
Well, I got to do a shout-out first. All right, Mike Gaines gets a shout-out. He was a Patreon in the past. His card was declined or something weird happened with it, so he stopped being a Patreon, and now he's a Patreon again for a larger amount than
all
the
right,
first time.
Mike.
So thank you, Mike Gaines. You get your shout-out, and I won't even say Michael Gaines because you responded with something that was very rude and made me sad, so we won't call you that. We'll just call you Mike. Thanks, Mike. Now, we can move on to what Rob wants to do, shout-outs. Rob, why don't you just go ahead?
Well, I'm going to repeat shout-out from last week because I'm not sure whether this fellow listens to the podcast or not, but if he does, he's going to get a double shout-out, and it's simply because of his enthusiasm for the game and his willingness to stream local tournaments that have excellent pool playing played in them. This last weekend, there was a little tournament up in northern Minnesota in a city called Eveleth, at a bar up there, and in the finals that Robert Montgomery, my shout-out to Bob Montgomery, streamed the finals, which was Scotty Tollefson and Rob Matson, a couple of premier bar table 8-ball players. And I just appreciate that, him doing that kind of thing, because I enjoy watching quality amateur 8-ball on a bar table played. It's the game that I played most of my life, and these players I'm very familiar with, so it was kind of fun. It gets kind of personal when you know the players personally, and then you can watch them in these local tournaments. So, Bob, I'm going to thank you for doing your stream again, and shout out to you.
All right, Demetrius, why don't you take it away?
Yeah, I got a shout out to our man Tyler Steyer. So Maybe I'll have a chance to talk a little bit more about it. But I had the opportunity to spend a day, a night, and a good chunk of the next day at Tyler's house last week. And man, he didn't just, you know, like I took some lessons, whatever, training. I don't really know, whatever. I trained with Tyler. I had the chance to go train with Tyler. And not only was that awesome, but like for him to have me into his house and, you know, it'd be basically, you know, cook up good meals and spend time together and watch pool and watch snooker and break down the game and do some training. It was a really cool thing. And he was just, the fact that he opened up his doors and was that warm and genuine and excited. Like, I've known Tyler, I've played him. I've crossed paths with Tyler enough times in the last 5 years, but that was the most time one-on-one I spent with him. And I just, it was kind of a highlight of 2021 already. And I just want to say thanks to Tyler. And so there you
go. Was that down in Waukesha, or is that where he was?
Yeah, he's in Oshkosh. Yeah.
Oh, he's in Oshkosh. Okay.
Yep.
So he's got his own place in Oshkosh then.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. I didn't know that.
All right. I will give my shout out, and I'm going to give a shout out to Kareem, who is the CEO of Predator, and he's going to get a shout out for a lot of different reasons. One, he, of course, sponsors all of my big streaming events with Poison Cues. And two, he sent me a set of Predator cloth, which is going to be released very soon. I don't think it's quite out there on the market yet. But if I guess you're lucky or important or lucky enough, I fall in the ladder of that. you can get yourself a set of them already. And I got a set of the Predator cloth, and I get to put it on my friend Maria's table, who I guess is the beneficiary of this because I don't have a 9 foot dime or a 9 foot table, I guess. But I thought that was just a really cool gesture, and it was he had offered it up for free basically just because we were working together, and he's really taking care of this podcast extremely well when it comes to the streaming side of things, and I think that easily warrants a shout out for all the stuff that he does to allow basically all of the things that we do to happen. So thank you to Kareem.
And I want to jump in. There's one thing that Tyler, there's a lot of things I'm not going to share that were personal, but Tyler is a very, you know, he's a sponsored player of Predator. He spoke so highly of Kareem. He just went on and on about how he is just completely devoted to the game, how it's so much of the money that they, you know, he could have in his pocket, he's putting back in the game in different ways and different promotions, whether it's running tournaments or adding money to tournaments or helping, you know, sponsored players or just, I mean, whatever. The guy is just all in on pool, all in on growing the sport. He's out there networking and trying to bring in outside sponsors outside of pool. And, you know, anyway, I don't even want to get into it, but yeah, I just want to let you know that, like, the players that work with him 100% agree with what you just said.
Yeah. Well,
I think that was the first hybrid shaft I had was a Predator 314. Actually, way back in the day.
Actually, it might have been mine, too. I think I had a 314-2. But I never liked, I personally never liked the shaft, and I've never liked any of the hybrid, well, the quote-unquote hybrid ones. I don't consider the carbon fiber hybrids. I mean, if you want to define it as that, whatever, but
low deflection.
Yeah, well, carbon fibers aren't even really low deflection shafts. They're just a fundamentally different type of shaft. But anyways, we don't have to get into any of that stuff right now. I guess that gets all the initial stuff out of the way. So why don't we move on to our ads for the day?
Some new strings on this.
And we are here for the wonderful Manscaped ad, and as you can hear in the background, Rob is warming up a guitar. What in the world are you going to do for us, Rob?
The strings on this thing, and they're all flying all over the place.
Well, weren't you prepared? You're supposed to be prepared for these things. What are you doing?
I'm not. I got to tune it.
Wow. Well, this should be fun at least. I guess Demetrius and I can talk. Demetrius, how's your manscaping going?
Yeah. Well, I'll just say this. For anybody that's wondering how manscaping has changed my life, I was really struggling. The only thing I compare, if you've seen The Wizard of Oz, and you remember how the beginning of the movie was in black and white, and then after the hurricane, when or the tornado rather, when Dorothy stepped out of the house and everything was like magical and in color, like that's kind of what Manscaped will do for your life. So I just, it's kind of like, let's get with the times, man. This ain't black and white anymore.
I can agree with that. In fact, I exclusively use it to shave my beautiful, not quite prepubescent face, which is great. So I get to use it about once a week on my beautiful face now. It's exciting stuff. Rob, are you ready yet? We're really struggling to ad-lib this. All right, let's just go through some talking points. You get going on that, Rob. Talking points. Happy 2021. Spoiler alert. Hairy nuts are still gross. Step into the new year with the tree standing taller and shave your boys. Manscaped is here to give you the New Year's resolution that you actually want to keep. The Perfect Package 3.0 below-the-waist grooming pack to start off strong this year. Come out of quarantine with your clean balls thanks to the Lawnmower 3.0 and waterproof and skin-safe trimmer. We'll reduce the nicks to your two best friends. The third-generation trimmer even has a light to shine a light to the promised land 2021 looks to be. I think we're going to get to hear a song.
Ready?
Go ahead.
You got Manscaped, your Manscaped. You got to make those little boys glow. Manscaped, the landscape with the Lawnmower 3.0. Your balls, they will thank you. They will even want to show. Your balls, they will thank you. You got the Lawnmower 3.0.
You need to tour, bro. We need to get you on tour. A Manscaped tour.
I got to tune it better.
We are like, we are wasting your potential, Rob. We are absolutely wasting your potential.
We're gonna take this thing on the public, man.
If this is not enough to get you a Lawnmower 3.0, I don't know what is. But make sure you use the code QITUP at manscaped.com, and you will get 20% off plus free shipping with the code QITUP at manscaped.com. Your balls will thank you. All right, so there was not a lot on the docket for the last week. There's been no big matchups, really. There's been a couple regional big tournaments that plenty of professionals showed up to, but I don't know. I don't really – if you guys want to say anything about this right now, there hasn't really been anything big enough on the radar that I feel it's worth covering. What do you guys think?
Yeah, there's been regional stuff, but no real, like, there's been no world-class tournaments, no international fields and, you know, on 9-foot tables or anything like that. So I'll just say, you know, Shane McMahon, he kind of earned a recognition. There was a tournament last weekend in Missouri, and I didn't really know much about it, but Jesse Engel was there. He's a friend of mine. He took third in the 9-ball, and then he lost to Shane McMahon, who went on to double dip John Hennessy. So Hennessy's playing good. And so for Shane McMahon to double dip him, I'll tell you what, man, Shane McMahon gets there a lot. And it's funny because I've played Shane a number of times and I've watched him play a number of times. And every time I've watched him, he wins the tournament. When I was down in Olathe last time, he won the one pocket and the 9-ball, the bar table 9-ball with 128 players and a huge team. And then, you know, it's like every time when I was in a tournament in Omaha, he ended up winning that one. And it's like, it seems like every time I watch, he wins a tournament. And I said to my buddy, I said, even if the only tournaments he'd ever won in his life were the ones that even if he never ever did anything except when I was watching, just with the tournaments I've seen him win, it's a pretty impressive resume. And I know that that's just the tip of the iceberg. And so then it's like, I've really watched him play. And I'm like, how is he, I mean, what does he do that? I mean, he doesn't strike you as like some really, really top player, but he's very effective. And so anyway, I spent a lot of time kind of really looking closely at his game and kind of figuring out what I think allows it to be so effective. But anyway, I feel like that's worthy of a mention. It's good to know that he's hitting the balls good.
Yep. Sounds good. All right. Well, let's jump into the things I guess we're going to talk about. Let's talk first about the exciting news that we have coming down the pike. And that is we are actually going to be merging podcasts with two other podcasts out there in the industries. So we are going to be merging with the American Billiard Radio Pool Podcasts, which is hosted by Mike Howerton of AZ Billiards. And Nick Olson of Chalk is Cheap. Now, we are making a live video of this today, the 16th of February. So this will not be released before then, of course. But I will release this afterwards, either tonight or tomorrow morning. I do have pool league tonight, so if I have enough time, I will do it tonight. If not, it'll be done tomorrow morning. And basically, what does this look like? If you're a Patreon to the podcast, you already know this because we announced this yesterday for the Patreon. So if you want fun information like this early, you could always become a Patreon at patreon.com/queueitup. But regardless, you'll find out about this very soon. And what does this actually look like? Well, I guess when you really take a step back and look at this, when I first started doing this podcast with Rob in the first year, we were basically pumping out between the two of us three podcasts a week. And that was when I really tried to start expanding in the podcasting realm. We tried to bring in a lot of new people, a lot of different stories, a lot of different players, stuff like that. And it worked out really well for a while until I tried to do that as more of a career, and it just didn't work because there's just not a, you know, there's just not a lot of opportunity to make enough money to survive, really. And so I diversified a little bit, brought in streaming, brought in selling cues as a vendor, brought in doing lessons, you know, small things like that. That, you know, they're in and of themselves, none of them are enough to sustain a lifestyle in promoting pool, but all of them together is enough to get me by. And when you diversify that much, you start losing the opportunity to just focus on one particular thing, which is obviously what happened, because now we're down to about 1 to 1.3 episodes a week, something like that on average. And I didn't feel it fair to the people who, you know, kind of gave me my start as a podcasting host that you guys are getting basically significantly less content. So there's two ways of really looking at this. Either I can get to the point where I just stop sleeping and create more content that way, or I could try to get a little bit more creative and diversify the way that we do things at the podcast. I obviously decided the latter. You do not want to be around me when I'm not sleeping much anyways. I get very grumpy. But we decided to. Demetrius has been taking on. He's only made one podcast thus far, but I don't want to speak for you, Demetrius. I think you're going to get a little bit more involved with the actual making of content going forward.
Yeah, I can rock out a podcast a month, or, you know, maybe even a couple of months. So yeah, I'll be throwing in a few podcasts. Yeah,
we will still be doing our regular episodes like this with Rob, myself, and Demetrius. But you're going to get the bonus every now and then. Let's say an average of 1.5 to 2 or whatever it is going to be from Demetrius. Plus, I'll still sprinkle in my, you know, about two podcasts a month of industry or player interviews. But on top of that, now Mike and Nick are going to be actually making content under the Cue It Up networking umbrella. So we actually changed the name of what we're doing. This is still going to be the Cue It Up podcast, but they are all going to exist within an umbrella of the Cue It Up network. And basically all of the podcasts that they now create are going to be released on this platform. So you should be getting about maybe another 1 to 2 episodes from Mike Howerton and another 1 to 2 episodes from Nick Olson as well. So in a perfect world, right now we're doing about 5 to 6 episodes a month, something like that. In a perfect world, you're still going to get those same 5 to 6, plus you're going to get another, let's say, 2 from Demetrius, 2 from Nick, and 2 from Mike Howerton. Now you're looking at about 2 to 3 podcasts per week, which is where we were at in the beginning. And we think that that's a pretty decent number, not only for keeping content out there, but to really allow us to diversify some of the content that we're actually creating so that we're not just getting updates from the industries. We're getting, player profiles where we talk about, individual players and we learn more about them. We learn about the industry leaders that are doing things on the front lines of, really growing this game. And I think that with between 10 to 15 episodes a month, we're really going to be able to diversify the amount of content and the uniqueness of the content that you guys are getting. And I think in the grand scheme of things, this is going to be a really cool change that everybody's going to be able to get on board with. So that is basically the big backstory behind why I approached Nick and Mike with basically this idea to merge our podcasts. So did either one of you guys want to talk about that at all real quick?
Well, I think it doesn't matter. You're just grumpy all the time, whether you get sleep or not.
Out of all that I just said, that's what you said, Rob? That's what you take away from it?
That's what I'm taking away from it, yeah. Because that's what you started off with. You predated this thing with the comment that,
That is true, I did.
You want to get some sleep so you're not so grumpy.
That is true. I do tend to get grumpy. But it's a
friendly. So you're not sleeping at all, and you never have since I've known you. Ooh, oh, laugh.
Don't even get me started with you, Mr. Grumpy Gills. Do we have any real serious comments?
No, I think that that's the main thing is that what we don't want to do is be at a spot where the amount of content that we're releasing is intermittent or especially, even if it's kind of like a little bit slow and then all of a sudden, we run into a virtual event and everyone's off the grid for 2 weeks and it's like we have to have it set up to where when one person is busy that the thing keeps trucking along. And so we want to, not only avoid gaps, but we want to have regular releases. And then when you have higher volume of content, that's good. But then the danger is that it starts to all sound the same or become repetitive. So then by having different people brought in together, we can have totally different focuses. So we can have, like you're saying, we have different voices focusing on different things. So it just seems really, really logical. And I'm excited, man. I think it's going to be good.
Somebody made a comment on Facebook about how exciting this is going to be. And then they named Demetrius and Rob as kind of not being excited about this. I just read that today somewhere. And so I was just wondering about that and whether that was a joke or not, or whether that person was serious. Do you know anything about that, Nate?
Well, Rob, you're referring to a private chat between the people involved. And so I stand behind what I said. You haven't said a single word welcoming our new teammates, our new family into this beautiful umbrella of the Cue It Up Network. You have not, to this date, welcomed them and said you're excited to be working with them.
Well, I didn't. I was supposed to say that. I have no script, Nate. There's nothing in front of me telling me what to say.
No, you got to be creative. That's why, remember what I said, Rob. I said I welcome them. I said it's going to be good because three is always better than one, except in Superman 2 when the three villains they got lured into the Fortress of Ice and it didn't make it too well. Other than that, though.
That was okay. Funny.
So anyway.
I like that. Yeah, the more the merrier, for sure. There's no question about that. And especially to have people that are podcast savvy and have been doing it for a while.
Yeah.
So now you got experience and you've got enthusiasm.
That ultimately is going to be our goal is we want to continue giving you guys some great content. We don't want to all of the other side projects that I am getting involved in. And for full disclosure, I am going to be involved with a lot more new things coming up, which I will talk about in its due time. But some pretty exciting things. So some pretty big doors have been opened in the last few months. Really the last few weeks for me in the industry, and I'm pretty excited to jump into those projects as well. But until then, of course, we're right here, and we want to make sure that you guys are still getting enough content that you don't feel like you're getting shorted. So that is the motivation for the merger. This is it for now. I don't foresee us doing anything else with this in the future. We're going to see what this looks like for a little while now, and maybe in the future we could try to diversify a little bit more and maybe bring in not new people, but try to get more people involved with the what we're trying to do here. And it might even be a situation where we have some we might have maybe some Patreons that we'll start a new tier of the Patreon, and if you want to actually do interviews or be part of the shows, you can actually get hooked up with some of your favorite players. For example, I've had this idea in the past where you name your favorite player, I get you an interview with them, and you can actually interview them as an episode for the podcast. I think that'd be a really neat idea. I'd have to see how that looks or how that works, but I think it'd be a pretty cool thing to actually get some of the fans who have been around the show for a long time involved with the show in some sort of way. So I think that could be fun. Other than that, that's basically the news for it. So did you guys have anything else you want to close it with?
I'm good. It's good.
Yeah, it sounds great. Yep. Sounds great, Nate.
All right. Well, yeah. From here, we will talk about...
The listeners can find some value in all this.
Yeah, we're hoping so. From here, let's move on to... Demetrius, you already teased it with your shout-out, but you said that you were training with Tyler. What did that look like? You wanted to talk about it for a little while, so why don't you take a couple minutes here and tell us what you two were able to do.
Yeah, it was really interesting. So I had, a good chunk of time with Tyler. And originally I was going out there really just to work on the break, but of course I'm open to anything, you know, that he wants to spend time with me on. And so we ended up spending way more time than we had planned on. He actually, originally it was supposed to be like a little, you know, afternoon, and it turned into an overnight. So, which is awesome. And we got into it. And so I think the first thing that stood out was how differently he and I approached the game. And it's amazing that it's the same table. Like, it's amazing that we're playing the same game with the same rules. The only thing I can kind of compare it with is, like, there's certain games, like, for example, chess, where you see, like, AI is coming on real strong, and you get to see what the top engines are doing. And they make computer moves that are so different than anything a human would do. It's hard to believe that it's, like, nobody's ever thought about playing moves like this in thousands of years or hundreds of years, and it's, like, totally alien. And that's how I felt. Like, I felt like watching Tyler play. So it's more specifically, there's kind of two schools of thought. I have the school of thought where it's like, I try to make the game as easy as possible so that I take pressure off the execution. You know, I don't want to have to make long, hard shots and elevated shots and power draws and big swing speeds and all this, because those are difficult. And so my whole game is based on, you know, cue ball, you know, percentage patterns, that take pressure off your cue ball so that you have real accurate cue ball and really natural angles so that you can use rolling cue balls and natural swing speeds and softer swing speeds and really high accuracy patterns and short cue ball movements with really, really crisp. I mean, like, it's all based on keeping everything really, really easy so that a caveman can do it. Well, Tyler's kind of the opposite. He's like, he's all about, like, let's just beef up our games where we can do anything and just run the table over. And I think, to be fair, that's probably, like, among the top players, that's more along the lines of, like, if you look at Jason Shaw, Josh Filler, that's more along how they play. And so, now, I'm not saying that it's all that way. There's guys that play my style, too, like Ralph Souquet, Nick Varner. I mean, there's been plenty of players that, you know, kind of play a little bit more keep-the-game-easy type style. But it's just funny to spend time together, because the stuff that he was showing me was, it was a culture shock. So that was my first experience, was, like, Everything we did on the table for those 15 hours, I was bad at. Like, everything we did. It was like, it's like, you know, you sit here, I get to a fairly good level of pool where I'm actually kind of competent at the game, and then it's like, we go there, and everything he sets up, I'm bad at. And it was just like, oh, man, this and that and all these things. I'm like, all right, that's fine. I can dig it. So then this leads me to my second big takeaway. And this is actually almost a coach's corner rant, but I'll just keep it real short. I'll just say, I realized something by spending time with Tyler, is that I've made too many concessions. I've accepted too many limits. See, when I was 13 and 14 and 15, I was young. I was putting in hours, and I was like, I want to be the best in the world. And so I was excited to take on every single challenge on the table. And as I got older, and as I realized, you know, that, hey, with my resources I'm going to put in, and the time and energy available, and the years I have in my life, I'm not going to be the best in the world. And also, I was looking at stuff that I've tried for 10, 20, you know, 25 years, and stuff that, like, hey, I guess I'm just never going to be good at this, or that's just not something, I guess I'm just, that's going to be something I just never learned to do, or that's going to be something that I'm never going to be good at, or I'll have to work around that, or I'll have to just not, you know, that's just not going to be, like, I've kind of, like, little by little, I've made concessions. And so, if there's extreme, like, you know, extreme things like very difficult shots, or, you know, length of the table banks, or power draws, or not, you know, just different things, I might be like, yeah, I guess I'm just not going to really do that. Well, what the problem with that is, I spent 24 hours with Tyler, and Tyler's the opposite. He's like, he's young, he's knocking on the doors of elite pool, and he's like, I'm going to be the best in the world. So therefore, his attitude is kind of like, it reminded me of what my attitude was. And I'm sure a lot of us have this experience where his attitude is still in that, no, I'm going to learn how to do everything, and I'm going to be the best at every part of the game, because that's the way you become the best in the world. And he's not trying to compete with me, or he's not trying to compete with, you know, whoever. He's trying to compete with exactly Federer Gorst. And so he's like, yeah, everything. I'm going to learn how to do everything and be the best at it. And it was just such a shock, because I didn't realize how my attitude has eroded over the years, from being like that to being more along the lines of some kind of middle-aged guy that's like, yeah, I guess I'll have to work around this or that, and I'm never going to be good at that, and I'll just have to. And I didn't realize how out of shape I was in terms of that attitude until I was side by side with Tyler. And it made me realize something, which is if Tyler is embracing every aspect of the game, and if he's kind of unlimited with what he's trying to take on, and if I've accepted some limits, then the problem with that is, you know, so you start saying, okay, I'm not going to be good at these really hard shots and these really extreme stroke speeds and all these trick shots, and I just work around that. Well, then the problem with that is, as you draw that box, now you've created limits for yourself. And then what happens is, over the next couple of years, the stuff that's on the outside of, you know, the stuff that's on the edge of the box you drew for yourself becomes the extreme stuff. It didn't used to be the extreme stuff. It used to be the extreme stuff was outside of that box. But now that you've drawn that box and avoided the stuff outside of that box, and you've set those limits, now the stuff on the edge of that box becomes extreme to you. So stuff that stuff that used to be normal, now it's as far out as you go. And now that seems extreme. And so then little by little, that becomes too extreme, and you make your box a little smaller. And then your comfort zone keeps shrinking, because every time you shrink your comfort zone, what used to be normal starts becoming extreme until you get smaller and smaller. And it made me realize that your comfort zone doesn't stay the same. It's either growing or it's shrinking. And I will tell you, I realized that in some ways my comfort zone has been shrinking the last few years, and that my attitude has eroded in terms of that wanting to take on every part of this challenge of this game, and that I've set some limits, or I've made some concessions, I've accepted some limits, and then I've allowed that to kind of erode me now. And I've been able to do well with it. In some ways, there's been some benefit to that, because by accepting those limits, I've learned to play patterns and cue ball really well, to where I've found ways to play the game simple and easy and natural, and it's forced me to strengthen in other areas. And I'm playing, and there's been a lot of positives, but it hasn't all been positive. And it wasn't all deliberate choice. It was kind of that's the thing. It wasn't like I set out as a strategy to say, yes, I'm going to do this. It's like I allowed it to happen without realizing it. And that's the part I didn't really care for. So I'll pause there. But what are your guys' thoughts on that? Have you ever gone through anything like that?
Yeah, I think that's a natural progression. Tyler may have started out with the attitude of being the best, like you did when you were young, and it sounds like you two thought, when you were younger, you thought like Tyler does now. So it wasn't new to you; it was just something that wasn't recent. And you discovered that your old self, you kind of discovered by being with Tyler. But I'm in your court. As a make the rack, make the game as simple as possible. even if you know how to play the great shots or do the two railers or three railers or what the kick shots or whatever in the game, the banks or whatever it takes to win. But if you make that game simple, you're just going to win more. You just are. You're going to make fewer mistakes. And that's how I always looked at it. It was just, if it's simple, you, how can you miss if it's simple? If you're trying, if you're focused. And so playing position for me was, how close can I get to the ball I want to shoot next? It wasn't necessarily exactly the right angle, but how close can I get to it? Because the further away you are, the harder it is to control the cue ball for the next shot. And that worked for me my whole life. I never really thought about what you're talking about right now as even being part of the game for me. Of course, because my purpose was never to be the best in the world at the game. It was just to be the best I could be at the time, which is a little bit different.
Well, there's no doubt that I do think there's a ton of value. I'm not changing anything about what I do or what my game plan is or what I train. I think that the model, for anybody that's not devoting their life, spending hours a day practicing difficult shots and taking on world-class competition, I think that making a priority on keeping the game simple and easy is still very important. But I do think that the shrinking comfort zone and the kind of making concessions and then little by little realizing you've conceded more than you wanted to. Nate, have you gone through anything like that, or what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I want to take this in a different direction. I'm still young enough that before I start what I really want to talk about with this, because I think it's an interesting topic, I do want to say that I'm young enough and I'm stupid enough probably to, and I don't want to say that Tyler is like that, but you know, there's a fearlessness and an inability to take no as a younger man or a younger person in general that I think you become a little bit more cautious with age. I think that's just a standard general thing. And some people say, you know, you become more cautious. Some people say you become more realistic. Of course, all of those things are real, but you can't separate being quote unquote realistic from advancing in an area, right? So when you become quote unquote realistic, you no longer have the no at all never taking no for an answer kind of mentality to it. And there is something to being told that you can't do something over and over and over again, and kicking that person in the face by doing it, right? Where a realist might say, "Well, yeah, you're probably right. All right, I guess I'm just gonna work within my box now." There's this big long discussion that we could probably have between what is the benefits of never taking no for an answer and working at something it's going to happen. It's just a matter of time. And what's the benefit to being quote unquote realistic and not maybe wasting your time on something that's going to be very difficult to get to, even if it's not impossible, very difficult to get to. So I think that that's a discussion that's very interesting, but that's not quite where I wanted to go with this. Did you want to say anything about that quick before?
I'll just say that it wasn't, we won't have that conversation. I'll just say that for me, it wasn't people telling me what I could and couldn't do. It was years and years of trying. And so I think that's the biggest thing with age. It's not so much caution. Maybe there is some of that, but it's like when you've worked on something for 25 years and you haven't developed the skills at it, it's easy to kind of just, it's hard to be as bright-eyed optimistic as you were when you just started working on that thing. And so after decades go by and you're like, yeah, I think that's the thing. But and there is, to your point, I think there's value in bold attitudes. I think there's a lot of value in being realistic and finding ways to actually put your game together that work. I think you can go out of balance either side. You can go out of balance pounding your head against the wall and never developing an effective game because you're insisting on trying to play it in a way that doesn't work. And I see that far more. I see most players.
Yeah, I see that a lot.
Most players are trying to set up hard shots and practice their backswing until they make everything all the time. And I'm looking at it like, man, do you want to learn how to play this game or do you want to keep shooting that shot? But then, to be fair, there's another extreme where if you go too far on either side, if you go too far on the side of like accepting too many limits and not pushing yourself and not and being too nitty or too cautious and too conservative, that's not good either, because this is a game where you have to pour your heart out and get out of your comfort zone and expand too. So I think the answer's, you have to gain the value of both and you have to be kind of balanced, and you have to be aware of that balance. So I think that's really cool. Thanks, Dave. So where did you want to go with it, though?
I would say if you could only have one or the other, which would you want to have? Would you rather have the overly cautious game, or would you rather have the?
I don't think either works. I think you'd I'm sorry, but I don't think you can say one or the other. I mean, because I'd love to say, well, just have the. I mean, my first reaction would be to say, well, I just want the guy that's like, I'll just walk through walls and keep going until I figure it out. But at the same time, figuring it out is learning what you can and can't do, and then learning how to take what you can do and put it together really effectively. Like they're both kind of superpowers. You kind of need both, I think.
Interesting. Do you think that the virtual pool playing ghost type pool versus playing competitor right there on the site has anything to do with that whole picture?
Well,
either one of you guys.
I would say absolutely far and away the running through walls, balls to the wall type of player is much more beneficial at a ghost style event than somebody who's overly cautious. Because I think part of the discussion that goes into this is the player who's going to go for everything and sees an avenue for everything is going to say, all right, well, I can make this shot, no problem at all. While the quote unquote realist says, well, yeah, I can make that shot, but the better play is the safety here, and that's the higher percentage shot I'm going to go for that. So when you're taking somebody who would normally be playing a potential safety and you're pigeonholing them into having to go for a shot, they're not going to be quite as refined on that skill. I think if you take two players that are at the same Fargo level, I think not all Fargos are created equal, and I think there's aspects of the game where certain players are going to be better at certain aspects of the game, and I think firepower is one that is definitely beneficial to the ghost power or the ghost pool, and firepower tends to be a higher skill level of somebody who's, you know, a little bit less cautious to the game, I think.
Yeah, that's a real good point. Yeah, I like that analogy with what you just said there. Yeah.
Demetrius,
Nate, was there something else you wanted to add? Because otherwise, I was just going to do a quick I'm not going to spend much more time, believe it or not, but I thought I'd at least mention a couple things we trained on. But was there anything else you wanted to talk about with that, or did that kind of hit it?
Well, there was, but then I kind of forgot what it was.
And if you think of it, I was kind of – I didn't mean to hijack you. But
well, I kind of gave it away, so that one's on me. I forgot.
How many players do you know that are over the age of 40 that can play to the level that Federer plays to, or – the top or Tyler, the top players.
Well, Federer and Tyler are two different things.
That's a different category.
Plays that, but if you wanted to mention, like, you know, who's like Tyler, you know, top 100, you know, I mean,
I would say nobody plays Federer
because you've got like, what level are you talking? Are we talking like the top 30 in the world, like alongside of like what?
Yeah, they got to all be under 40 years old, except for maybe Ralph.
Like the guys that are playing top players, the guys that are over 40 tend to be guys like Efren, Earl, Johnny, guys that were top of the world that are still able to play very, very good. And that's why you still see these guys in the 780 to 770 to 790 Fargo rate range. I think Ralph's in the 780s. Earl and Johnny are like 770s, stuff like that. But like they can still play really good, but that's because they were 820 at one point and then they kind of fall into this. Yeah. Now in terms of like up-and-coming players, that if you want to talk about players that are peaking in their 40s, I don't know anybody that's peaking in their 40s that is in the top 30. But the only thing I would say to that is as I say that out loud, listeners might get the idea that I'm saying, like, oh, it's a young man's game, and you can't, if you haven't done it by 40, you can't make a move. That's the only thing is, anybody that thinks that that's where I'm going, it's like, no, I disagree, because for other than exactly those players, nobody's goal is to be number one in the world. And I don't think, you know, my goal is not to crack the top 20 in the world. And so my age, if that was my goal, was to beat Federer in a race to 100, well, then my age would be a factor. But if my goal is to become the best player I can be and see continued improvement and play the game at, you know, higher and higher levels, well, that's a goal I can accomplish at any age. So, I think that's my thought.
Yeah. And that's, yeah, I think that's interesting. I can't name a single player above 40 right now that is in the same category as Fedor. And I would say it's more or less not be. I mean, Fedor's, there's only, what, six players in the world that are around Fedor's level, we would say.
And, how old is Mika now?
Mika's probably in his mid-40s, I would guess, 44 to 47.
Yeah, I guess he's 42. Over 40. Yeah,
44 to 47, somewhere in there, I would guess. And that's kind of where Niels is at, kind of in that range. Ralph is just a tiny bit older than that. You know, these kind of, these last, I should say, previous generation European champions are, well, I think what it is, this game is really hard to make a living at. And if you're a younger guy, like a Josh or even a Fedor or Tyler, something like that, you don't have a lot of overhead as far as, you know, a family, a house, like a mortgage. Just, you know, there's not a huge amount of commitment that requires you to have a certain amount of income as a baseline every single month. You know, you can't make $10,000 one month and then go 3 months without making, you know, $500 and expect to feed a child at home, right? So I think there is something to, you know, these players that are in their 30s, you know, late 30s, 40s, 50s, they tend to have a family that they need to support. And when you have something that you need to support and you're playing in a game that's as inherently random as pool is when it comes to like winning purses, you just need something a little bit more consistent. And I think that might be part of the reason why you see these players into their 40s not being able to compete, not because they physically aren't able to, but because they just don't have the time and ability to be able to train at that top level to get themselves to the point where they can compete with somebody like Fedor, who's training 60 hours a week.
I think you already said it, because I don't know that it's the time and resources. I actually think you already said the answer, which is that the young guys, like Fedor, you know, when you're 17, 18, you don't have the weight of the expectation on you because you're kind of like up and coming and like, hey, I'm not supposed to win. You know, when Filler was first playing Shane and when Fedor was first winning. So they don't have that pressure of expectation. They're like, but the other thing is that they're on this upward trajectory to where they've gotten better year over year over year over year. They're getting better quickly. And basically, to your point, they have no evidence. The world has given them no evidence that they can't just get to the top. And they've got nothing but positive momentum and positive energy and positive, you know, optimism. And what happens is that if you stall and then you have 5 years where you're in that, you know, like if you pick a pro who gets to like the second or third tier level, like say 750, 760 level, and then that player kind of stalls out there and starts, you know, has 3-4 years where they're at that level. And so they're kind of like losing sets and getting beat out and they don't know how to get to the next level. Like all of a sudden they start to realize it's kind of like when you're climbing, they say, don't look down. Like once you look down or once you lose momentum, then it starts getting so hard that like trying to believe that you can close that gap, getting to the top of the pool, getting to the top of the pool is almost impossible. And it's basically impossible. But somehow a few people in the world believe they can do it. And once people get old enough to where they start to realize how tough it is and they see that they've started to slow down and that they've, you know, things aren't coming together, like it's so hard to believe you could do it. And I'll just tell you this. I remember talking to Jesse Engel once when Jesse had gone out into pro pool and really spread his wings when he was 18, 19 and was starting to kind of play those international events. And he came and told me that he was starting to have doubts about whether or not he could get to the top level. And he told me, he's like, yeah, I'm not even sure if I want to keep trying. I just don't know if I have what it takes to close the gap, and maybe I can. And I told him, I said, Jesse, hate to say this, but once you have this conversation, once you start to question whether or not you can do it, like, it's kind of over. Like, because you're playing against guys, you're kind of playing against guys that spend every day dreaming of nothing else about except what's going to happen when they get there. And if you're, you know, if you're already kind of like not sure if you have what it takes or not sure if you want to put in what it takes, like you're competing against guys that have zero doubts. And it's kind of like, it's like breaking a brick in karate. Like if you break your hand, you break your hand, but there's only one way to break the brick. If you go swing at that brick where you're kind of checking your swing and afraid of hurting your hand, like there's no chance. And so I think Nate, you said it best when you're like, these young guys, they're like all in, going to get it done, no questions, no stopping. And they've just never had any negative feedback from life because they've never stalled out. They've never really run into a lot of big patches of life where they've run into like 5-10 year stretches of adversity or slumps. And they just it's like to get to the top of pool, I really feel like you either have to blitz it or it's not going to happen. That's what I think.
You know, I'm going to think back to when you played Mika in the virtual event that you played in. And at, when it was over, Nate asked Mika how, you know, what he's doing to get his game in shape. And he says, oh, he just kind of casually said, oh, well, I'm playing about 10 hours a day.
Well, that, I mean, that's kind of what it takes, right?
Okay, he's 40-some, and he's playing. And he's been playing, he didn't say for how long, but playing about 10 hours a day. Yeah. Well, for anybody in their middle 40s playing 10 hours a day, physically, that is just tremendously demanding of your body to do that.
And that's kind of what my
brother as you get older, I think, is that demand just gets higher and higher and higher.
Yeah, especially when you start throwing a family and, you know, mortgage.
Yeah,
and all that
stuff. Pool,
because you know the
fatal for the
that.
Majority of people, you have to have a level of gratification that you're happy with and content with. Because most people are not going to be professional pool players. Most pool players are not going to be that. By far, 98% of all pool players are just going to play it and try to be as good as they can be at it. And that is an age thing that is going to happen. I've gone through, you know, four or five different stages in my age where the physical fact of aging is playing a part. Just ask Ron Dobuzinski how he plays now with his eyesight the way it is, as difficult as it is. And you could see that happening in his game as it was happening and progressing, his eyesight getting worse and worse and worse. And not to mention your body just isn't going to handle the even the stress of one stressful match. After you're done with that match, God, you just want to take a nice long nap. Yeah,
well,
all kinds of factors.
I still don't remember what I was going to say, so I guess it probably wasn't that important. Are we good there? Were we ready to move on, you guys?
I'll just mention one thing. This is actually so to me, I'm not going to go into a lot of the details of what we actually trained on because that's for Tyler. But I will say that his approach is geared to, you know, he's very fundamentally sound, and he's, you know, worked with me, you know, between setup, stroke, aiming, but also a lot of what he works on is really stroke type shots, and he was able to show me a lot of what Johan had trained the Moscone Cup team on, some of the stuff that they did to prepare and some of the stuff that Johan did. And so he actually spent a lot of time telling me what he learned from Johan and working on that stuff. And that's not mine to share with the world, but I'll tell you, that was a really, really cool treat. And I did pick up some things, and I'll tell you just one little thing that I did is that on this sounds obvious, but, I know that I saw this when Nate came over to my house and he was, you know, power drawing the ball around, that he has a longer bridge.
Yeah.
When I tried to lengthen my bridge out, my tip accuracy went down and it was just not really working for me. But after spending some time with Tyler on certain shots, I lengthened my bridge. And what that did is two things. One, it gave me more room to accelerate. So I didn't need, I could use a slower moving cue stick that picked up speed along the way. And I didn't need to accelerate. So I was starting to get more action with less effort. And then also on the break shot, which is something, as you guys know, it's been like, with a longer bridge on the break shot, not only did that help with my acceleration, but when I was a little further from the cue ball, I was able to sight the break. And so sighting the break to where it hit was very difficult. And by just being back a little bit further, it kind of helped me. So anyway, it doesn't really matter. I mean, I learned a lot of little things and I learned some big things. And so, but I think that's interesting is not only did he show me some physical things that are helping and some things that some drills to work on that I will admit that were like, wow, I have like avoided all these things. And now I think that to recap, I'll just say that it really got me excited to take on kind of say, no, I don't want my comfort zone shrinking. I want it expanding. And that doesn't mean I have to play stupid, but I want the best of both worlds. And so I want to, do the Johan stuff, and I want to take on some of these challenges and shots that he's working on and just keep working on it. So it was a good time, and if you're in the Wisconsin area or not, I think if you have the opportunity to train with Tyler, I think that's a great move.
I would recommend that also. I spent one full day with Tyler about 3 years ago, and something I'll never forget. I mean, it was just great. I walked out of the Tyler's house. It was his parents' house where he was doing it with me, and with kind of some extra ammunition in my tank for a situational pool. In other words, you know, when you get in those places and times in a match where this is a situation, you say this is, and yeah. Yeah, I would recommend him for that kind of thing too, at any level, really, from 500 and up.
Well, and I would push back on that at any level, because I mean his mechanics, his understanding of the mechanics of the game, or you wouldn't want to build a game on anything but that. Although I do push back hard on some of the pros that are teaching the elbow drop to amateur players. I think that's a very advanced technique that I don't think it should be incorporated anytime soon. But that's also just me. So that's just a pushback, sure. I guess. But I've also worked with Tyler. We all are kind of on the same page there. I learned a lot of the breaking knowledge that I have from Tyler. So yeah, he's great. And anybody in Wisconsin, I think he's like decently reasonable too. It's like $200 an hour, which for a pro player,
they are. He gave me a heck of a deal. But you know what I liked about Tyler was his patience. Even though when I went to him, I was 65 years old, had a whole life full of pool.
Yeah,
he still treated me with patience.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a time I asked him a couple questions, and he couldn't answer them. And he had to call Stan up to get the right answer for me. He says, "Hey, Stan here, can you answer? I got this guy, he's asking me these questions. I don't know how to answer these." And it was because of the level and my history in pool that usually he's giving people instruction that aren't going to ask those kinds of questions.
Yeah.
And so they were new questions to him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was cool that he took that time, called up Stan, got the answer for me right away. He didn't know the exact answer, but he got it. And I think for that's very respectful of whoever you're trying to teach to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I would say there is a huge, huge, huge maturity to admitting you don't know the answer and willingly getting the right answer. I think that there's a lot.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of people.
Yeah. Grabbed his phone, called up Stan.
There's a lot of BS that can be out there where people just kind of make up an answer on the spot, and that doesn't do anybody any good. But
that
I see it a lot.
That would be the thing that most people do. Yes, they would just kind of try to make something up and sound real smart at the time. Yeah. You know,
I started a podcast
and
off of doing
I'd
that.
I had a lot of respect for that.
I started a podcast off of doing just exactly that, Rob.
Oh.
I thought it was a
Which one was that? Maybe I'll listen to it.
Well, actually, I guess I haven't even said this. I actually do have another podcast coming out. Maybe I'll talk about that one later on.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on from there. We have the last thing that we want to talk about is my partner, Jim. Made a post on Facebook, and it exceptionally triggered Mr. Robert Hovick. So we thought that we would talk about it. And let me actually just basically pull it up, and we can talk about the exact quote of it, because I think the exact quote of it's kind of important, I would say. And while I'm pulling this up, because I was prepared at one point in time, and then somebody sent me a message, and I accidentally left the Facebook page where I had it pulled up already. So let me get to it. And here we are. All right, so this is in Scottish English, so it's kind of weird as far as like if you're an American listening to this, but it's all easily understandable. He asks, or he posts, ask yourself, are you a professional pool player or just a pool player? I'll ask you again at the end of this post. Pool player goes from tournament to tournament trying to earn some money. Between tournaments, does nothing, maybe a money match, but basically just waits for the next tournament. A pool player will allocate time outside of his or her tournament for work besides, because it is their job, working on his or her brand and promoting the sport. A pool player will get a sponsorship and stick a patch on his shirt. A professional will actively work for his or her sponsor for the benefit of both and the sport. A pool player will check the dress code rules before a tournament, and if it's allowed, will just dress how they feel like. A professional will let his or her own standards, and has a uniform that they will wear when they go to work, in quotations, both of those things. A pool player is happy to just play and follow the crowd. A professional will set and raise the standards in order to improve for themselves and the future sustainability of the sport. One is a leader and one is a follower. Being good at something is not enough to be classified as a professional. Just because you're paid to do so doesn't not make you a professional. It is an attitude. It is how you carry yourself and positively influence others. I could go on and on, but ask yourself again, are you a professional or just a pool player? So basically the point of his post here is to call out the professionality of the professional pool players. And I think that is more or less taking a shot at the Americans, because not only do I talk to Jim regularly, but, of course, Europeans don't have this problem, really, do they? Right? So I'll start with this one because I want to. I agree with everything Jim said there. There is a difference between being somebody who makes a living off of pool and somebody who is a professional at their trade. If you look at the professionals in other sports, when you see them, they have a full uniform. They are doing the things that they need to do on and off the field. They conduct themselves as a professional, and I don't even mean that as far as like classiness. You still have people like who's a bad boy? I mean, even Earl Strickland, right? We can look at Earl Strickland within the industry, and I would consider him a professional, even though he kind of has that bad guy mantra to him, but he's a professional because he wears a polo, he wears a jersey, he wears, you know, dress pants and dress shoes. He doesn't show up to a tournament in shorts and a ratted t-shirt. He might do some antics along the way, but the idea is he looks the part. Now, his personality doesn't always have to mirror it, as far, you know, there's not one proper professional way to act at the table and act away from the table. But the idea is when it's time to go to work, when you're doing your job, you look the part and you act the part. I think that's not something that you totally see in the U.S. In fact, very, very rarely do you actually see that. When we watch these regional tournaments, you have Corey Duell that still dresses as a professional.
He does.
I don't know of another player that does that every single time. Maybe you guys can correct me there, but Corey Duell always shows up to an event, whether it's Matchroom or whether it is a regional event. He always shows up looking like a professional, looking like he's different than the people that are there just basically to play a pool tournament. And I think that's a really important thing to do. It adds the professionality to the sport that it so desperately needs. But
yeah.
Well, Rob, you really pushed back on this. So why don't you go from there?
Well, I did in a few different ways. I pushed back on it. The one way I pushed back on it, and it made me feel a little bit sad when Jim said just the pool player, because when you put the word just in front of that, you're saying that the pool player isn't equal to the pro in the what they're thinking. It's not just the way they're dressed or the way they represent the game or anything else. And to me, I thought, I looked at the sport and I thought, well, gosh, almost everybody out there who plays the game in the United States is just a pool player. That's what we are. We're pool players. We're not professionals. But I thought to myself, how many pool players, in the terms that Jim is talking about, have all those credible assets that the professional player who's using his platform to show the quality of human being he is are just like that, only they're just pool players. And I said, I know a lot of pool players, just pool players, who are those kinds of people who don't take the game shabbily. They're respectful to their opponents. They're respectful in the way they act and look and carry themselves. And there's just so many more of them, I thought to myself. So to me, it was kind of a little bit of a slap.
I see how you're taking it, but I think that the way he asked it, he says, so you're taking it to me like all the non-professional players are only pool players. I think he's addressing people who think that they are professional pool players.
He
says, ask yourself, are you a pool professional or just a pool player? So if you're not a professional, if you don't think of yourself as a professional because you're just a hobbyist, whatever, I don't think he's talking to you. He's calling out the people who think that they're pro players that are just going so I think that's why there was
Difference for me. I don't feel like shunned because I know a lot of professional, well, I don't know a lot of professional players, but the ones I have met, half of them I didn't care for because they were kind of snobby and you know, they didn't have a great attitude.
I would say
weren't people I'd like to hang around with.
I would say at the end of the day that they're in any sport that you talk about, and I struggle to put pool in the terms of sport, but I will for this. There are people that you're always going to hate. You know, you're always going to have your John McEnroes who, you know, but when John McEnroe was out there, he looked like a professional. He might not have always acted like a professional, but he looked like a professional. He represented the sport that he had in the bare minimum way, which is showing up in proper attire with the proper equipment and at least addressing his opponent in a professional manner. At least as a start, right? I mean, the idea is you're always going to have bad boys and you're always going to have these people. And those people are very, very, very marketable. Don't get me wrong. But the idea is when it's one or two people, it's very, very marketable. When it's 80% of your industry, it's a degenerate sport. And mm-hmm. I think that's what Jim is basically saying here is at the end of the day, you can have people that are going to be, you know, out there on the fringes kind of doing, you know, maybe they'll show up in shorts and a t-shirt from time to time. But as long as it's like a few people, whatever, you know, you can market those people and they can actually build potentially a career off it if they're great players as well. But if you have an entire industry that does that, you don't have a professional sport. And if you don't have a professional sport, you can't market it as a professional sport. When you watch snooker players, if anybody out there who watches snooker, they are always dressed up. Always. And that, in my mind, is more of that is a professional sport. I don't look at pool, at least in the U.S., as a professional sport. Now, in Europe and in Asia, I do think that pool is a professional sport because it's treated as a professional sport. But when you have, and I can go straight down the Fargo list in the U.S., and, you know, I'm not trying to take shots at anybody, so I won't do it, but I would guess, in fact, I'd be willing to put a huge wager that if you went to, let's say, just a random pool tournament in the country, let's say the Music City Open, and you went through there, I bet there would be 20 of the top 100 pool players in the country there. I would bet there are less than two of them that are dressed as professionals as if they would be if they went to the Moscone Cup. Or the World Cup of Pool, or the Whirlpool Masters, or even Derby City Classic, right? Because that's a little bit more of a high profile thing. I would venture to guess that you treat those not as professional pool tournaments. You treat those as, you know, just I don't know. I guess as Jim would call it, a pool playing tournaments.
Yeah, Americanized tournament.
Yeah.
I see that in three cushion billiards. I started playing 5 years ago, three cushion billiards, and when I started, almost every tournament, even a small tournament like in Illinois, down in Rushville, there was a dress code
Absolutely. That
you had to abide by, or you wouldn't be able to play. You had to wear a vest, you had to wear a bow tie, you had to wear, you know, a nice clean shirt, nice pair of slacks, and you couldn't even wear tennis at the time. And now, this sport, and I just saw out in Arizona, they had a Mazen Shuni had a tournament out there, and they're relaxing the dress code for three cushion billiards, and that is only happening in America. It's not happening anywhere else.
Well,
in the world.
thing one thing I want to pipe in, because listeners might be getting the idea that what we're talking about is dress code. Jim mentioned dress code, but it was one of many things
right.
he talked about,
right.
because he was also talking about allocating time outside of tournaments to invest
and
in
and I did want to get to
that.
I was,
right.
You know, spending time and actively working with your sponsors, you know, raising standards, not just with dress code, but in terms of conduct and in terms of the future sustainability of the sport. He's talking about being a professional. He's talking about being an ambassador to growing the sport. He's not just talking about dress code. So that's all we've talked about, and that's a big part of it, but that's only one part. Like, for example, Corey Jewell may dress nicely, but I don't know that he is the most selfless promoter of the game.
No.
Okay. He's pretty much, I'm going to go get mine and get me against the world.
Yep.
Like, he is an American player in that aspect. And I have no problem with Corey, but he has not done anything other than wear a polo shirt. So my thought on this, I'm kind of mixed. Okay. Because for a few reasons, one, you know, I get what Jim's saying. Like, it's not for Jim to determine what a pro player is or isn't. So, like, but he's not saying that he is the guy. He's just posing it. He's
expressing. Yeah, that was just opinion.
No, he's expressing his opinion.
Yep.
Now, my thoughts on this are that there's not, you know, where do we get these ideas? I mean, the thing is that from the 60s and 70s, pool players in the United States were roadrunners that ran around and played money games and went into towns and saw who was the best player. And it was a gunslinger and shootout. And that was our culture. And that continued into the 80s and 90s. And that's why when we look at the U.S. players, so much of U.S. pool is about being able to go into any room, play for any amount of money, be the guy that's like willing to flip it for the bankroll and, you know, do all this. Like, that gunslinger who, you know, match up whooping at each other. Like, that was our history. And so I'm not saying that that's what we should do. I'm just saying to look at it and say, well, look at how backwards we are. It's like, well, that's where pool was in our country for many, many years. And so if what he's saying is we should see that change, then the only challenge I have, the only part that kind of sticks in my craw a little bit, is if we're talking about what the players should do for pool, it's like, yeah, but what does pool need to do for the players? It would be like if I had some company, if I just say, hey, I'm starting a company and I'm not going to pay anybody anything. In fact, you're going to have to fly here and spend money to stay in a hotel and work for me, and I'm not going to pay you, but you better dress sharp. It's like, what? Like, you're not paying me? I'm going to go lose money to come work for you, and you're going to bust my chops about a dress code? Hell with that. Like, the fact is that it goes both ways. And so you talk about sponsorship and a player that's going to actively promote for their sponsor. But if the sponsor's whole thing is, I'm going to have you wear a patch on TV, and then I'm going to give you a discount on cues once a year, or I'm going to give you a free shaft. Like, if that's what they're doing to support a player, then it's like, there's a problem. It's a two-way street here. And what has pool done for the professional players to warrant this? Now, the argument there is, well, the pool players have to grow the business so that it, you know, you have to make the fire before you get the smoke, and you have to act like a pro and invest in the game so that someday it gets better. My problem with that is there's been no growth. And again, this is one of those things where it's like, you know, I'm a little bit more jaded because I'm older and I've seen failed tour after failed tour after failed tour. But this has been the same conversation I've heard my entire life, which is, well, players got to do more, got to do more, got to do more, and make it work. It's like, no, nobody, like, there's been many players that have done many things, and there's never been any kind of return or payoff or any kind of benefit to them. Now, finally, and you can respond to any or all of this, but my final thing is to say, I'm hoping this changes. But when you talk about dress codes, it's like, there is a dress code. And so if somebody wants to come in, if Matchroom wants to come in and say, you know, we're going to add money to the game that's going to get all the top players competing, and then we're going to set the standards. Like, I think you can't, I think you got to hold the promoters responsible. The promoters have to lead. There has to be some organized body of pool. You can't sit there and say, we're going to have a bunch of people fighting over peanuts and then squint at them because they're not raising the game from the inside enough. I think a promoter has to come in and say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a big international tour. We're going to have a lot of events, and then we're going to set the standards. And then we're going to change the reputation of what it means to be a pro. I think Matchroom is the one that's defining what professional is. And I think that if they have dress codes and they have major events and they keep adding tours and they keep adding visibility, then I think they have a chance to change it. But to think that
thousands of random pool players across continents with different cultural backgrounds are just going to somehow unite with a common vision and then work it effectively. I don't really see it. And I don't, yeah, that's it.
Well, yeah, I agree. But I guess the way that I look at not showing up to like a tournament in like saggy pants or like shorts or t-shirts or stuff like that is like what I envision, like the bare minimum of like wiping your butt as a professional pool player. Like at least look like you aren't some homeless guy that just crawled in off the street looking for $5 to, you know, get a sandwich.
It's so mixed though, because like for so long that was glamorized that you're the guy that like, I mean, slept under the table. You're the gangster. I mean, look at Dennis with a sideways hat, and look at Shane where he shows up with, you know, like half the time Shane, you know, and it's so weird because it's like they're all like multiple personalities. Like half the time they show up at these events clean cut, looking really professional and signing autographs. Half the time they show up with bling and backwards hats, ready to like throw it out and be gangster.
Did Mr. Compton just have a sideways hat on a one-pocket match?
Yeah, so it's just like, it's like, are we gangsters or are we professional? And that's the thing is we don't have... You know, what Jim is saying, I love what Jim is saying. I'm just saying
I didn't like it.
There's no united vision. And so you can say that, or Jim can say that we want, you know, we should carry ourselves as professionals. But, man, half the country around here grew up thinking that we wanted to be gangsters. So it's like, you can't really blame pool players for wanting to be gangsters, because then they go see Dennis with a sideways hat gunslinging for money, or Tony Chohan. Like, look at, we're watching Tony Chohan, and he's up there. He's not an athlete. He's wearing bling, and he's got, you know, he's just, I don't know, it's like... We need direction, man. It's a direction issue. It's not a player issue.
Yeah, I tend to go with you on that, Demi. That would help the whole attitude about pool. It is, you know, I do see a change. I've been around for 70 years. I've seen a change. And some of it is good, and some of it is maybe not so good, but there's change, and there's people like you and people like Nate on the podcast here and Nick and Mike that we're going to talk about later that are on board with this thing and, you know, Matchroom, like you said. And these are the guiding light in the industry, and everybody's got to be on board with it. And I think we will. I think the players will get on board with this. There's always going to be that one or two. I can remember running tournaments where we'd have a dress code, right? And invariably, there'd be 1,300 players at this tournament. 1,295 players would abide by the dress code, and 5 wouldn't. Every single tournament we ran.
That was
big. We'd have to send somebody back to their room, you know, to get on a pair of shoes or to put on a pair of pants that didn't have rips and tears in them. And it was always the same 4 or 5 people.
Yep. All right. Well, I think I agree on the Matchroom point. I think that's definitely a direction going forward. And if you don't like it, well, then you miss out on the 6 biggest prize pools of the year. But I think we can leave this there. And really, I do want to emphasize it. I mean, literally,
we can come back to this discussion in the future also.
And I think that might be a
decent idea. An important topic.
I mean, I honestly really feel like just at least appearing as a professional, separating yourself from somebody who's showing up to the tournament, in, you know, those silly shirts that they used to have back in the day, like the FBI female body inspector shirts, like those stupid things. Like I've actually seen professional pool players wear that before in the past, and it's like just separating yourself from what is a regular pool player, I think, is like the equivalent of like wiping your own butt. I'm not surprised
that somebody from Europe came up with this and made a post about it. That just stands to reason because of the way they look at the game from a young age over there. Well,
it's so much more professional.
One thing I want to say, you're right about that, Rob. And one thing I want to say is when I was in sales, it was all about incentives, right? You get what you're going to pay people to do. And if they had a model where they only paid people on production, then you would see people gaining stuff and doing things that were borderline unethical or across the border and all kinds of things to get widgets produced if you were paid strictly by widgets. But when they turned it, so instead of just paying strictly on widgets, it was like widgets and quality and customer satisfaction, and they had different ways of measuring different things beyond just straight production, then those other things started to change. And so my opinion is if you only reward and pool players on their performance, then all you're going to get is performance, because you're going to get a bunch of crazy people willing to kill each other to get to the top of a ladder of competence. But if you have and so there are some examples, and as much as I was, maybe I'm talking myself around on a point, I used to kind of not like the Moscone Cup selection because I liked the idea of just meritocracy, who are the best players. But if they're saying, hey, we're going to recognize good players that have good appearance, that are good ambassadors for the game, that are professionals, then now all of a sudden, if you want to be invited to the Moscone Cup, performance isn't the only thing. And if Matchroom, as a leader, it's up to them to set up the incentive. So, for example, if they had big tournaments where they're adding a lot of money and it's a payday, or if they paid salaries or promoted sponsors, you know, sponsored players to where there was a financial payoff to players to be included on their, you know, nice list and not on their naughty list, then they could say, you know what? Here's the requirements of being part of Matchroom, is that you wear professional attire at any pool tournament you go to, even if it's non-Matchroom sponsored. You don't get into, you know, whooping matches, and you don't go into back rooms and play big gambling matches unless it's a one-on-one promoted challenge match, in which case you dress professionally, and blah, blah, blah. Like, this is our expectations. We want you to spend, whatever. You need to be updating us on what you're doing to promote pool. Like, they could set up those standards, but then they would have to be able to offer something good enough that the players would want to, you know, make those sacrifices and investments to be part of that group. And so for the Moscone Cup, that's a small thing where you get to see a handful of players that might be in contention for the Moscone Cup trying hard to clean up and be presentable and marketable. Well, some of them. Anyway, but then, sorry.
What are the chances of that again?
I really do think it's on Matchroom to set the stage as, are we, I think they've got to be the leaders.
No, I agree. All right. We can leave this here. We are going to do a nice short episode, and this turned into, you know, the same length as what we always have. So I don't know. I guess that's just how it goes. Yes, we are going to be doing a live Facebook interview today. Of course, this will not be released before then, so you're not going to know this, I guess. But to announce all of the things that are coming up as far as the swapping or the merging of the podcasts. So that's some pretty exciting news for us. Other than that, next week we'll have a little bit better of a vision of what that's going to look like and how it's going to be going forward. But for now, I think it's a good time to sign off. What do you guys think?
Okay.
I gotta go help, develop, promote the game and, give back to the sponsors. So, yeah.
The sponsor that you don't have?
Yeah.
Wait, I'm the closest thing to a sponsor you have. What are you going to get me?
I'll tell you, man. I'm jumping on the call at 4:30. Rah, rah. Let's go. Team Cue It Up Network, baby.
Team Cue It Up Network.
Yeah.
Shaking all right. Hands and kissing babies.
Nick has to be excited about this, really. Oh,
certainly. Rob? Good luck with getting your autism or whatever you're getting later on.
I'm going to get the chip implanted in me, yes, so the government can take control of my mind and body. I'm ready.
Yep.
Maybe it'll help your pool game.
I'll deliver it. No, nothing can help. I don't shoot in pockets anymore, so I don't have to think. But I can shoot in the corners of my billiard table. Dead corner, right? That's the center of the pocket.
Something like
that's right.
All right, well, let's
and
leave
the ball
it there.
Always comes back to me. Yeah, doesn't go in the pocket.
All right, let's leave it there. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and until next week.
Later.
Okay, see you, folks.
Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. If you've liked what you've heard and you want to contribute to the future content that will be made, consider joining the podcast's Patreon at www.patreon.com/cueitup. Becoming a Patreon of the podcast will help to create all of the future content that the podcast will have. Special shout out to Dave Peters, Aaron Taylor, Pete Silsby, Morgan Lupton, Ben Young, Robert Miller, Andy Morse, and Bill Pelham for your generous contributions to the podcast's Patreon. If you ever need any more information on what the Patreon system is or how you can contribute outside of the Patreon, please reach out to the podcast or Nate himself. If you would like to contribute to the podcast for free, consider sharing any podcasts or the podcast page on Facebook itself. Also, leaving a review and a rating if you listen through iTunes. It helps others find the podcast. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Cue It Up podcast.